On this episode of Still Loading, the game that swears with you, not at you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval, and today on the show, I have a very special guest for you all. The creator of one of the most iconic arcade games of all time is here with me today. You may remember the character as Q-Bert, the lovely little creature that loves to swear with you, at you, however you interpret it. And with me today is Warren Davis, the creator of the game. Warren, how are you doing today?
I am doing fabulously, Josh. How are you doing?
Doing very well. Thank you so much for setting aside some time for this. I've been looking forward to this all week. I wanted to talk to you because, one, I'm a huge fan of video game history. I love learning about it. And I'm coming at this from an interesting angle, though, because I was born after Q-Bert came out, but I love video game history. And so I wanted to speak to you because you created Q-Bert, one of the most important and iconic games of all time. And one of the things I actually found most interesting about doing a little bit of research about you is that you came to video games kind of in a roundabout way. You didn't necessarily want to start out in the game industry. You wanted to be an actor, correct?
I would not say that. I certainly became both, but I started out as an engineer. Being an actor was something I started doing in college and I just did for fun. I don't think I ever really envisioned a career of it until I quit my job with Bell Laboratories and moved into Chicago to study, even then, not acting, just improvisation from Second City. So I was inspired by Second City, and Chicago was the only place at the time where you could study improvisation. And it was while I was studying improv that I actually saw the job at Gottlieb. There was an ad in the paper, and I actually started working for Gottlieb while I was actually taking improv classes. So it's not like one came before the other. And the other thing is, I was an engineer in college. You know, I was studying engineering. That's when video games came out. That's when I was first exposed to them. And man, I would have loved to believe I could have a career in video games back when I was in college. I just didn't think it was possible. I just didn't know how a person got a job like that. But yeah, acting is something that I really didn't take seriously until later.
So you enjoyed video games before you got into the industry. I was actually going to ask, like, was it something that you kind of discovered after you got hired, or was it something that you always had an interest in? But now it's clear that you did. So what were some of the games that you enjoyed before you got into the industry? What were some standouts for you?
I was there from the very first video game. The first video games came out when I was a freshman in college. So every time there was a new game, I just ate it up. You know, Pong. If you can imagine a time when Pong was new and revolutionary. I know it's very difficult to imagine that.
Well, and every company had their own version of it that they would sell for their home consoles and stuff like that.
Well, yeah. And then, of course, you know, it didn't take long for there to be, you know, Tank and then Nibbler and then Breakout. And, you know, so but literally, you know, throughout the 70s, I just, you know, I was a huge video game fan in the arcades. I didn't have any home system. I didn't own a home computer. It was really a social go out to the arcades and play kind of a thing. But, you know, Time Pilot, Pac-Man later on, you know, Missile Command, just there. Yeah, tons of games that I loved.
So then you ended up working for Gottlieb, but you didn't initially, like, what was your degree in initially? Because you weren't doing game programming at first. You were working on other things, right? What were you working on professionally before you got hired by Gottlieb?
I was an engineer. I my undergrad degree is in computer and systems engineering, and then my master's was in electrical engineering.
Okay.
And I worked for Bell Laboratories as an engineer doing really test writing and test performing on their new revs of software for their operator system.
Okay.
But I did have a little stint with their R&D group. I was on loan and I did some hardware design. I designed some pattern matching hardware for a speech recognition system, which in the late 1970s was, you know, definitely futuristic. That was science fiction. Mm-hmm. But really all we were trying to do there is recognize digits that were spoken by anybody. So speaker independent digit recognition was their goal, but was only on loan to that group. And it was when they wouldn't let me permanently move to that group that the testing was fun for a while, but after a while I really, really wasn't satisfying me. And that's when I kind of mm-hmm. quit and moved into Chicago and started studying improvisation.
I get you.
It wasn't game related, but it was engineering.
And then you saw, I believe I was reading somewhere, you saw an ad in the paper for Gottlieb, and that's how you got into working with Gottlieb. Now, were you, one, is that correct? And two, were you there from the start of them creating their video game division? Because Gottlieb was known for pinball machines prior to this. So were you kind of in at the ground floor for the start of their games division?
Not the ground floor. So basically, Gottlieb, as you said, was a pinball company for decades, family owned. But in 1977, Columbia Pictures bought the company. So it was no longer family owned. And it was, I think, in around 1980 or 81 where they started their video division to get into video games. And I think they mm-hmm. were one of the last pinball manufacturers to get into video games. I don't know if management just thought, hey, this is a fad, it's going to blow over. I don't know what the deal was, but eventually they realized they had to get into it. And they first got into it with some licensed games that they licensed from Japan.
Okay.
But it was, and actually that probably predates 1980 because I think it was in 1980 or 81 when they started their in-house department. That was the thing. Mm-hmm. So they started an in-house department. I wasn't there quite at that time. I started in January of 1982. Tim Skelly, who was the guy they hired with a track record because he had made a whole bunch of successful games, he was working on Reactor. In fact, he was almost done. He was sort of finishing up Reactor mm-hmm. When I was hired. And there was another game in the pipeline being programmed by a guy named Tom Malinowski. And I was sort of assigned to him as a supplemental programmer for a couple of months.
Okay.
So it wasn't exactly at the very, very beginning of the video department. When I was hired, the hardware was already developed. The tools were already developed, but it was a small department. There were only a handful of programmers.
So I actually had a guest on previously this year, actually, who help set up the games division at Gottlieb. Did you ever have any interactions with Howie Rubin?
Yeah, of course. He was my boss. Howie Rubin and Ron Waxman were the two guys who put together the Gottlieb's video department, and they ran it. Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be that surprising, I guess, because you worked for him, but it's just weird to me that within the same year, I interviewed Howie earlier this year, and it was by the most bizarre chance that I ever interact with him. It was on this new social media app called Swell. He knew the creators of the app, and so he was on it, and I just happened to interact with him on there, and that's how this all came about. So when now I have the chance to have you on, I was like, I wonder how, like you said, it was a small department. So I assumed you interacted, but I didn't know in what capacity or this or that. So he was your boss. You reported to him every day.
You couldn't be part of the Gottlieb video department and not interact with Howie or Ron. So they ran the department. Yeah.
That's crazy. So from what everything that I read about how you created Qbert, it was you and an artist, and I feel so bad. I'm just blanking on his name.
Jeff Lee.
There we go. Yeah.
The fantastic Jeff Lee. And Dave Thiel was the third member of our triumvirate, who is our sound designer.
Mm-hmm. I know you've talked about this before, but just for my listeners who may not have heard it, where did the inspiration of Qbert come from between you and Jeff?
Well, Jeff had actually created the character of Qbert before I even came along. When I was done with Tom Malinowski's game, it wasn't released, and so they were done working on it. And then it was suddenly like, okay, Warren, you know, make us a game. So I didn't really have didn't really have a game design in my head. It was my first game, game that I was going to be making on my own. And I also felt like I had more to learn. And so what I really wanted to do is teach myself some, programming techniques. And what happened was one day I was walking around in our, we had a big open space that we all worked in, and we shared these workstations. And Kan Yamamoto, who is one of the other programmers, best known for Mad Planets, which came later, you know, not much later. He might have even been playing around with that idea at the time.
From what I see, it came out in February of 83. That could be, but that's also from Wikipedia, so take that for what it's worth.
No, that sounds about right. It was after Qbert. It was the game that came out after Qbert. But at any rate, back in like March of 82, I was tasked with making a game, and Kan had gotten a screen filled with those cubes, that cube pattern. And Jeff had made that
MC Escher pattern type of thing, right?
That's right. And Jeff had made that for him, and it filled the screen because it was a repeating set of blocks. It, literally, I believe it was six background blocks, and you could just repeat that and fill the screen. Mm-hmm. But when I looked at it, I saw something a little different. It occurred to me that if you carved that into a pyramid, and if a ball fell on the top, it would bounce, and it would have two choices of which way to bounce, down to the left or down to the right. Well, that's binary. So as a programmer, I tend to like things that are binary. And
a lot also, simpler to,
if you think of every row in that pyramid as a bit, in one byte of data, you have the path of a ball, you know, completely predefined. And then, you know, there were other things that appealed to me. Just the gravity of a ball falling with gravity and then hitting a surface and bouncing. That was a challenge that I thought, oh, let me see if I can get something to bounce, because, you know, it's that pseudo 3D, but we're really in a 2D environment. So there were some programming challenges there, and I thought, let me just see if I can get that. So I did, and I asked Jeff to draw me up a ball, which he did, and I carved that full screen, you know, whatever background blocks I needed to give myself edge pieces, and poof, I had a pyramid and a ball, and I started programming, and I had a balls bouncing down the pyramid. So people looked at that and thought, oh, that looks pretty cool. You should do something with that. I did have a game idea. I didn't even have a player character, but that was the next step. I went to Jeff and I said, "Do you have characters that I can use?" And it just so happens he did, because Jeff was an inventive guy and he always had a lot of ideas. At Gottlieb, though, if you needed a programmer to make your ideas happen, and there weren't that many programmers going around, but Jeff was very gracious and he showed me all these characters, and they were, you know, amazing, because Jeff's an amazing artist. And I saw the one that was round with a long nose, and to me, he looked kind of pathetic. And I thought, yeah, that's my player character right there.
That's a good way to look at it. Like, I picked the pathetic one. It is interesting that you kind of approach it almost as creating a physics engine and then finding a game, like pulling a game out of the physics engine, instead of coming up with a game concept first and then figuring out a way to do it. I find that interesting, where you had an idea for just this cool thing to see, and then the game came later.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. And that's just kind of the way my brain works. I can't think of something that I can't think of, right? So I'm not experienced enough at that point to you know, come up with a fully fleshed out game design. And the reality is, it was like the Wild West, you know? There were no rules. You sort of made up the rules as you went along. So I started with a pyramid and balls bouncing down, and people liked it. And then it was like, well, the pyramid, it's like a play field. A player can jump around. And so that was the next thing I did. And it just literally continued on that way, one step at a time. Every time I did something, I thought, okay, that's cool. I like that. What should I do next? And sometimes I had an idea. Sometimes I had no idea, and the idea came from somebody else.
Do you feel like your work, your training in improv had any influence on your design on Qbert or any other games you worked on in your career?
You know, it's hard to say, but I do think training in improv is just valuable for anything you do in your life, because it teaches you a number of things. It teaches you to think on your feet. It teaches you to listen. Listening is a huge part of improv. And it teaches you to be fearless. You know, It's like, don't be afraid of going down this path, because you could just, you can go down that other path next, or you can, you know.
Yeah.
You can, you know what I mean? It's hard to describe if you've never done improv, if you've never actually stood on a stage and like improvised a scene, but there are guidelines to improv. It's not like there are literally, you know, you'd just say anything that comes to your head.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, but it's not entertaining to an audience. So, you know, there are, you know, like I said, guidelines that help you get through improv as a performance art. But I do think they're valuable in your life too. You know, you just helps you just be at ease no matter what you're doing.
The reason I ask that is because your design approach kind of reminded me of the whole yes and mentality that improv, I mean, that's a very basic tenet. I understand there's a lot more to improv than the yes and mechanic or yes and concept. And for those who don't know, yes and is just the idea of someone says something, you say yes, and then you add to it. And the way you kind of described your process with Qbert was, Warren designed a game. Yes. And here is my tower of, here is my pyramid with balls bouncing down. And then you almost said it to yourself there, where you're like, all right, yes. And how do I make a game out of this? And then you went to Jeff, got everything, and you just kind of kept pulling out the bit by bit. So that's why I kind of was thinking, like, how much did you feel your improv helped with that? But it helps with a lot of interpersonal skills, like you said. I took one semester of improv in college. I'm not an improviser. I'm not good at it. But I found it was an immensely fun class to take. So I do have a couple more questions about improv, but before I go too sidetracked, I want to stick on Qbert a bit longer. So once you started kind of coming up with the game mechanics, how did you decide to iterate on that to increase the difficulty?
Honestly, it was whatever seemed logical to me. It's whatever, you know, it really, mm-hmm. you know, this thing is, people tell me how groundbreaking that is, but nothing about it felt particularly groundbreaking to me while I was doing it. It all seemed just obvious I don't mean to diminish anything, but it just, you know, it's like, okay, well, if he's jumping on a square once, what's harder than that? Jumping on a square twice. You know what I mean? It's a, mm-hmm. it's not a huge stretch. And then like, well, what's harder than that? Well, you jump on it once and then you jump on a second time, it reverts back to the original color. That's even harder. So those kind of things were fairly obvious. They seemed obvious to me. As far as where to go to make things more difficult.
I feel like it's something a lot of people who create, who end up creating things that are super influential. I feel like a lot of people who create it say that, because it's like, of course, I mean, it's common sense to you. But that's interesting to people like me who maybe don't have that same thought process. That's why we dive into things like this. That's why I like to dive into things like this, because I'm learning someone else's thought process and learning kind of in a way of how they kind of approach different problems. And Qbert was, it's funny because now I've, you know, there's years and years of game development now, but I feel like the idea of like increasing the difficulty, I understand in the arcade business, part of it was to, you know, put more quarters in, you know, make players come back to pay again and try again. But like, what I found interesting about Qbert's difficulty is that it was a very logical progression, and it never felt like, from like, I'm bad at Qbert, full disclosure, I'm so bad at the game, but like watching other people who are better than me play it, seeing how the difficulty progresses, it feels very fair. It doesn't feel like it's trying to ramp up too quickly. It feels like it's a very gradual progression, and sometimes it's simple tweaks that make the biggest impact. So I wonder if that's where people kind of come at. I don't, at least that's how I view it for Qbert. It's like, it's a very simple tweak, but that simple tweak makes it, the difficulty, that much more noticeable, if that makes sense. I don't know if I'm explaining things all that well, but at least I feel.
You know, the tuning on Qbert was a little bit of black magic, because I had never really tuned a game. And mm-hmm. I didn't know how to judge whether something was too easy or too hard, because, you know, I mean, I wasn't a super fantastic game player. You know, that's one of the reasons why Qbert is tuned in such a way that after a certain number of levels, the tuning doesn't change. It literally doesn't get harder. because I could not envision anybody reaching that level. I was wrong, of course, but
I mean,
you know, but that's just the way it is. And the other thing that there was a lot of pressure when I was developing it in the office before it even went on test to kind of make it easier. I had it at a place where I was comfortable with it, but people who came, you know, that's the first thing you do with a game. The first sort of testing it ever gets is the people in the office come by and play it. And so that's feedback that's useful. And a lot of people are like, it's too hard, it's too fast. So, you know, I slowed it down, made it a little bit easier. You know, it was literally black magic because I had no way of knowing if it was going to be good or bad. I really just had to go with my gut.
I gotcha. So once the game came out and it sold super well, it became super popular. What was it like for you during that time, just seeing this explosion of Qbert, like in pop culture, in the zeitgeist at the time? Like, there was Qbert merch, there was cartoons, there was so many different like things you could buy with Qbert on it. What was it like for you during that time seeing that happen?
It was nutty. It was weird. It was absolutely crazy. I mean, it really was, you know, people, again, nowadays may not be aware how huge Qbert was in like 1983. It was crazy. But the flip side of the coin is that I was completely anonymous. I mean, you know, nobody knew that I or Jeff or Dave, any of us, had anything to do with the game. We were actually interviewed. The three of us were interviewed for a video games magazine, and Gottlieb would not let them use our names in the article. So we had pseudonyms. I was D, capital D, period, Zyner, D Zyner. Jeff was R, period, Teist.
Was it spelled like T-E-I-S-T?
T-E-E-S-T-E.
Wow, okay.
And Dave was J, period, Walkman. So, yeah, it was very bizarre. And, the same article talked about Joust, because Joust came out around the same time. It was also a hit game. And the theme of the article is that these were two American-made games, when, like, all of the hits were Japanese games. These were like two super popular American-made games. But the people at Williams had no problem using John Newcomer's name or Eugene Jarvis or Ken Fidesno or Bill Futzenruder. You know, all the guys involved there, their names were in the article, but ours were not. It was kind of a weird thing. But anyway, the upshot is I was completely anonymous. I could watch, like I could stand at a bar and watch people play Qbert. And it was just like this huge satisfaction in me. And I would sometimes be tempted to say, hey, I made that game. But then I wouldn't, because I would think, you know, I'm just some schmo in a bar. Anybody could say, hey, I'm the guy that made that game. You know?
Yeah. No one would believe you.
Exactly. I didn't. I would never have expected anybody to believe me.
That's so surreal to think about, to create something that is that popular, but not be able to prove it to anybody at the time, except like,
I suppose maybe I could have brought the source code print out. I suppose
that is something.
could have started carrying that around with me. Not like,
do you still have the source code for it?
I do. I've got the whole listing. It's on, ribbon paper that has the little holes on the side and,
okay.
Dot matrix printer. It's like, oh, I want to say maybe like 13 inches or 14 inches wide. And oh, it's about 3 inches thick of paper.
That's so cool. Yeah. That's wild. There's I'm sure you've already heard of them, but like the Video Game History Foundation, they have like a source code project where they try to preserve the source code of a lot of video games and everything. So I don't know if that, I'm not a part of them, but I don't know if that's something that would interest you if you want to preserve that. I don't think they take it or anything. I don't know.
I actually gave my printouts. I have three printouts. I have Qbert, Faster, Harder, More Challenging Qbert, and Us Versus Them. I have the source code printouts for all of those. And I gave those to the National Video Game Museum in Frisco, Texas.
Okay.
John Hardy over there is a friend. And they were going to scan it for me and then keep it, you know. But I think I don't know exactly what happened, but I ended up getting them back, and I actually have a scanner, and I still have not scanned them all. I think I scanned faster, harder, more challenging qubits. So I have that digitized, but yeah, my goal is to scan all three of those. So at least, you know, there's a digital record of the source code.
And then, so
and then
cool.
I will give those originals to the National Video Game Museum.
That's so cool. Because, I mean, one of the things that they talk about at the Video Game History Foundation is that so often game developers get rid of, maybe not the developers themselves, but the company that owns the game, they just get rid of the source code because it was disposable product. They would make it, release it, trash it. And so a lot of source code is just gone. So when I hear developers still have the source code to their game, I always find that really cool.
I mean, listen, nobody ever thought that any of this would be remembered 40 years later. it was disposable entertainment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
6 months and on to the next thing.
Especially when you consider there was at least in North America, the market crash in 83. Like, at least the home console market. I think arcades were still fairly popular. But
the arcade world had a crash in 1984. And I think it lasted through 1985 before it started picking up again, I believe.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think it's just that perception by the companies. I'm not surprised because the markets crashed. So they kind of viewed this as like, oh, this might have just been a fad or something like that. Obviously, we're 40 years on from Qbert and it's still going strong. There's still there's a lot of interest in video games, in video game history. Hence, you know, you're on this podcast talking to someone who didn't even get to experience it firsthand. And I'm fascinated by it. I wanted to go back, though, to your time at Second City, because I was reading that you got to improvise with George Wendt, Norm from Cheers. Did I read that correctly?
Wow. No.
No?
That's a definite
no.
I saw George Wendt perform in Second City.
That might have been it. I might have misread.
Yeah.
You
that's
saw
a
George
very
Wendt
different
perform.
Thing.
Okay. Yeah, very, very different thing. Did you ever get to interact with any of the people who would go, you know, George Wendt went on to Cheers. Mary Gross was, I believe you also said you saw her perform and she went on to do SNL.
Yeah,
maybe
Mary
she was
Gross,
doing it at the time.
Tim Kazurinski. I actually talked to Tim Kazurinski in a bar once back in those days because I think he was playing Qbert and I knew him from Second City. And there was this bar in Chicago called the Gaslight Corner. It was kind of an actor's bar. But I remember talking to him about software. I told him that I made Qbert. And we were talking about computer programs to format scripts, which back then didn't exist. And I thought, wow, that's a really smart idea. Somebody should get on that. And of course, somebody did. And I didn't because I was busy doing other things. But that was an interesting idea that, good potential.
That's crazy. Do you still practice improv or do you still do anything? I know you're now you've acted and you do a lot more stuff in terms of, you know, acting. Do you direct as well?
I do direct. I've been directing theater and short films for many years, but, I'm not really acting that much since the pandemic. I did a play right before the pandemic. I did a play last year in 2021 as the pandemic sort of was starting to wind down. But I really haven't done much. And I'm just so busy right now with my book and promoting the book that I'd love to have time to do more acting. I don't really have that time right now, but I'm looking forward to having that time in the future. As far as improvising, I kept up with it. I kept going back to it every few years, but I haven't done it in quite a while. I mean, the thing is, there are people who do it so well. I just know people who they're such great improvisers. I mean, I was never as good as the people who are really good at it. So I might just leave it to them.
I was just curious because when I saw you improvise, it's like I love improv. Like I wouldn't say I took it in college. I was actually because I went to school for game design and it was one I had to take an acting class for it. And I took the improv class. But I like improv a lot. I listen to a lot of different improv comedy podcasts and stuff like that. And I referenced off mic the Alan Alda one. His whole thing is that he has a foundation that teaches scientists improv, so that way they can be better communicators in trying to communicate the difficult concepts that science that they're trying to study or explain to people like me who don't understand, who may not understand it. And sure. I thought that was super interesting. And so when I saw you were at Second City and you're an actor, I was just like, oh, I would love to pick your brain about this. Not because I have any experience. I'm just fascinated by the world of improv. How long did you stay at Second City, like studying there?
Well, it was a year program.
Okay.
I went through there, and by the way, this was the school at the time was the Players Workshop of Second City, and there was no Second City Training Center. There is currently something called the Second City Training Center, but at the time that didn't exist. So the only place to learn improv, literally anywhere I think in the world, was at least in Chicago. Was the Players Workshop run by Josephine Forsberg. And, you know, I ended up doing, we did our grad show on the Second City stage, which was a lot of fun. And I did a kids show that was directed by Josephine's son, Eric Forsberg. And that was fun. And then I went and started, you know, basically performing with an improv group. And we would perform at clubs around Chicago and things like that. And I did that maybe a year, maybe a year and a half, something like that. And it was fun, but it kind of got old for mm-hmm. me. And also I started becoming intrigued with what like actual acting was. Like I was trying to wrap my brain around, well, what is it? What is acting all about? So eventually what I did is I took a 2-year Meisner Technique program in Chicago. You know, and I just found that a little more satisfying than improv at that point. So I pursued actual acting and started doing plays and, you know, anything else I could find, you know, because that's what actors do. You just, you know, mm-hmm. just find the next gig. But meanwhile, my day job was always making video games. The nice thing about theater is it's nights and weekends. So, you know, you have your day times to do your day job. But I've always found that, you know, my jobs were always fairly flexible. Like if I needed to take an hour off in the middle of the day, I could, or if I wanted to work on a weekend, I could. So, you know, and that was the thing that always attracted me to any job is the idea that it's not about literally clocking in at a time and clocking out at a time. It's about getting your work done. It's about doing your job. So, I was able to do both.
That's really cool. To get back to the games you've worked on, your first game was Qbert, but then you went on and you worked on tons of other stuff, like just throughout the years. The from what I can see, the two games you designed personally, one was obviously Qbert, and another one was Revolution X in 1994. But you worked on a lot of other games. Did you design others?
Let me correct you.
Okay.
Revolution X is not a game that I designed. I was on the design team, but your question to me was, you know, games that I designed personally, which, Qbert was a game in which I was the designer. I mean, certainly I collaborated with Jeff and Dave, but nothing went into the game if I didn't put it in the game because I was the only programmer.
I get you.
There was another game I worked on called Exterminator, in which that was a very similar experience. I was the only programmer and the game designer. Also for Gottlieb, the Laserdisc game, Us Versus Them, I wasn't the only designer, but I was the only programmer. And Dennis Nordman, who had the original concept and developed the game with me and a couple of other people, Dave Faust and Rich Tracy, he gave me pretty much, you know, free rein as to the actual gameplay. So my contributions to Us Versus Them were very large. But when you talk about Revolution X, it was really the same design team as Terminator 2. And the leads for both projects were George Petro, who was the programming lead, and Jack Hager was the art lead. And so I was I was a senior programmer on both of those. And we also had a junior programmer. Both of those games at the core were six person teams. There were usually three programmers, three artists, and then we'd bring in more people as work needed to get done. But definitely more of a team effort, and certainly not me at the helm on either Revolution X or Terminator 2. This brings up a really interesting point, because it's very important to me that, you know, these details are known, and it's so easy to warp the details with one little phrase out of sync or out of step in an article online. And all of a sudden it's like a game of telephone where somebody misinterprets that, and then they retell the misinterpretation, and it just grows and grows and grows. And I've certainly over the years, I've heard, you know, some whoppers about Kubert that just weren't true. And, you know, so it's always very important for me to set the record straight. You know, I don't take credit for things I didn't do, and I don't, and I want to make sure that the people who did things get credit for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And we could talk about Wikipedia some other time, because I think Wikipedia gets it, you know, they might get it close to right, but they don't seem to always get it right. And they don't seem to care if it's right or not. They only care if it's verifiable.
That's why I try not to, I go off Mobi Games for a lot of my stuff, because they usually are pretty accurate with their credits. And that's why it's misleading in a sense. And that's why I was so confused before, because for
what
your
does
design
Mobi Games say? Let me go ahead, read it. Read off my credits for Mobi Games. I'll say what's right and what's wrong.
Your credits for Mobi Games, for production, you were the project manager for Lunar Explorer in 2006. Is that correct?
Yeah.
it said, so, and this is where my confusion was, the designed by credit is Kubert, and then just design is Revolution X. And that one letter by, or not one letter, sorry, that one word by is the big difference, because designed by would imply that you created it, and just design meaning you worked on the design team. So that one word makes a huge difference. The other credits that it has for you, of your programming and engineering credits, programmed for Kubert, obviously, Joust 2, Terminator 2,
that's correct,
Revolution X,
that's correct,
Cruising USA
with other people on Terminator.
Oh yeah, yeah, no. This is just showing what your credits are. It doesn't show, okay, like I would have to click into the game and then look at all the different credits.
Gotcha.
For everybody on there, because there's a lot of credits for these, obviously. Cruising USA.
I had nothing to do with Cruising USA. That was Eugene Jarvis and his team. The only thing I supplied for Cruising USA was my digitizing system.
Art tools. That's what it says. Yep.
There so you go.
It says you have art tools for Cruising USA and WWF WrestleMania.
Correct.
And you did art tools for Cruising World in 96.
Well, yeah, that just means they used my digitizing system. I wasn't actually involved.
And did I read this? Let's make sure that I read this correctly, because I've been screwing up left and right here. Did you create that digitizing system for Terminator 2?
It was actually created much earlier. It was created for NARC. That was the first game that used it. And it was, you know, the first iteration of the digitized system was fairly crude. And then before NARC was released, I actually left Williams. So I was gone making Exterminator for Premier Technologies. And then I came back to Williams for Terminator 2. And at that point, I picked up I was surprised that having been gone for 3 years, nobody had sort of, you know, picked up the mantle and improved the digitizing system. So I took it upon myself to continue to improve that throughout the next few years.
Okay. It also has you listed as software support for NHL Open Ice 2-on-2 Challenge.
No direct involvement in that game that I recall. Just just used my digitizer.
That might have been software support. So I wonder if that, I think that's the create, that there's not a lot of conformity with like credits back, I guess at one point in time. Now everything's become a lot more uniform. So I wonder if back then it was a lot harder. But then title engineers for Disney's animated storybooks, Mulan, and Tarzan's Disney Activity Center.
That is true. I did code those titles.
You worked at Disney Imagineering for a number of years too, correct?
No, for a number of months.
For a number of months. Okay.
Exactly. Disney Interactive for 4 years. That's when I worked on those two titles, as well as a number of other things, including tools. But it was after that that I went to Imagineering, but I was only there for 4 months.
All right. And then the last programming credit I see here is for Spyro Enter the Dragonfly. Were you the project coordinator and the senior engineer?
Yeah. I actually wasn't the senior engineer, or I guess there was a lead engineer. So I wasn't the lead engineer, but yes, you guys, you could call me the senior engineer. And project coordinator was a title I kind of gave myself, because that project almost completely fell apart. And I'm ashamed to admit this maybe, but I'm responsible for that title getting finished. But that's a whole other story that you asked me, if there was anything I didn't want to talk about. I don't want to get into too much details about Spyro Enter the Dragonfly.
Then we will not go into that. But you have nothing to be ashamed for. I'm the one interviewing you and getting all this information wrong. And I'm going to keep all of my mistakes in the final cut, just so everyone can hear.
Well, don't feel bad. I mean, you're not getting things wrong. You're finding some, and again, it's not, this information is not horribly wrong, but it's somewhat misleading in little bits and pieces. And that's the thing and not to change the subject, but that is the reason, one of the main reasons why I wrote my book, is to set the record straight. And, only in a book do I really have the opportunity to go into all the details about all the games that I worked on, and just sort of, set the record straight.
Do you even go into details for Enter the Dragonfly in the book?
No, I don't. But that's another book somewhere.
That's another
dark future, maybe. The book ends with Disney, with me leaving the arcade industry. So it's the focus of the book is my arcade games and my time in the coin-op industry.
Okay. So to get off of your gaming credits now, we've run through pretty much all of them. There's other things listed here in the thanks section, but those are more things that Mortal Kombat, NBA Jam, stuff that they used your technology that you referenced prior for. But I wanted to ask a bit about your acting career. We kind of touched on how you got into it, but when exactly did that shift happen? How did you first start getting roles either on film or on stage?
Well, I started doing stage roles because that was just what you did. I mean, there was a lot of theater happening in Chicago at the time. We're talking now, I think by the time I finished my Meisner class, it's probably like 1983 or so. And there was just a lot of like little small storefront theater happening in Chicago. So I started, auditioning. Getting cast in a play here and there, nothing fancy, no big theaters. But, once you're sort of in the circuit and in the mix, you meet people, they become your friends. And then so everybody sort of gets elevated gradually over time. You start going to working at bigger theaters, or you get that one job in a bigger theater, and that just helps you. And then more people know you, and you get an agent, and that was a standard thing. You'd go to the agents and, find yourself an agent, and then they'd start putting you out for short films or independent films, or if a TV show from LA came to Chicago, you just start going out for that stuff. So I just sort of was thrown into the mix. I was not steering an acting career. I was literally going with the flow. But I loved performing, and I especially loved theater, and it was something I had more control over the theater I did than I had over being in film or TV. Because you're at the mercy of the agents and things like that. But for theater, I could set up my own auditions, and then it was all up to me. I would either get cast or I wouldn't. And I had some amazing theatrical experiences, and I would do theater like gangbusters. There were times where I might be in three different plays at once. I'd be at a regular, your primetime weekend slots, but then maybe I was doing a late night show somewhere else, and then I was doing a midweek show somewhere else. When I think back of it, I don't even know how I had time to do everything, because I was still making games during the day. That was my day job.
That actually gets me to think of another question. I had a guest on a year or two ago, and he was talking about the comparisons of game, the type of media that video games are, and comparing it to other types of media. And a lot of times people always compare video games to movies and whatnot. And his argument is that video games are closer to theater because, like a video game, every time you play it, it's going to be slightly different. Every time an actor performs a play, it's going to be slightly different. The audience that shows up each night is going to get a slightly different performance, just like everyone who plays a game is going to get a slightly different outcome in how they either play or how the game interacts with them. What do you think about that? Like, do you agree with that idea, or would you compare video games to some other type of media?
Well, what you said is absolutely true in that, you know, a play is going to be a little slightly different every time. But I think the missing factor is that the player of a video game is the instigator of any changes.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because it's interactive. Most plays are not interactive. The reason they're different is because of the actors, you know, the little nuances that an actor is going to bring that are different every night. So I think it's a small but crucial difference, because the interactivity of video games is what makes it fairly unique in the annals of entertainment. You know, improv is a little bit more interactive with an audience because you ask for audience suggestions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's something. And of course the audience's suggestions will make a show 100% different, you know, not like theater where you have a script.
Yeah, yeah. You
know? So I would say improv in that regards is more like a video game, because the audience is literally steering the result.
Would you say so? I that is a good point. I wonder. Do you think though you're welcome. Do you think that maybe, because I'm not an actor, but I would assume that how an audience reacts to a performance can kind of steer your performance a little bit. It's nowhere near the same level of interactivity as a player in a video game. And it's more of a collective interaction with the actors. But would you say that the audience does have a little bit of a sway, even if it's not an interactive play, even if it's just something of them reacting to what the play is and taking in the entertainment, whether there's a moment that's supposed to get a type of laugh or like you're waiting for something, does that change?
Yeah.
The audience is reacting, does that change how you perform going through it?
Yes. That's the answer. Yes.
Yes.
No, you're absolutely right. There is an energy exchange in live theater between the audience and actors. And that energy, you know, feeds the actors, or, you know, in some cases doesn't feed the actor. And that has an effect on the performance. So, you know, the answer is yes.
Yes.
Indubitably.
Indubitably. Oh, I can't even say it. Indubitably. Not going to try it anymore.
Try press the digitation.
Nope, not even going to go for that one. So let's start wrapping this up. Before I ask my final handful of questions, I wanted to ask you about your book. We've referenced it a little bit already. Talk about your book. Tell my listeners about the book that you just had come out. It's the 40th anniversary of Qbert, so it's just in time for the anniversary.
Yeah. It has a history at this point. It's been around in various forms. I first started thinking about writing a book years ago. I was doing retro gaming shows because they became a thing. And, you know, I was going and telling stories and remembering stories and running into old colleagues, and we would, you know, shoot the breeze. And then, you know, it was like, oh, yeah, I remember that. You know, and so there were a lot of things that came up. And of course, I've said this before, but not in this show, but I've said this to other people. I'm not by nature a person who looks back at the past. I'm always focused either in the present or in the future. So this whole notion of going to retro gaming shows and, you know, celebrating my own past, as well as other, you know, as well as other elements in the past, it's a foreign thing for me. It was a difficult thing for me to get used to. And, but as I did more of these retro gaming shows, I realized just how many stories there were, and I just didn't have time to tell them, or at least to give them their due in an mm-hmm. hour talk or a 45-minute talk. So I had the idea of writing a book, and I would, you know, and I would talk to Jeff Lee about this because we would see each other occasionally, and, you know, he wanted to write a book as well. And, you know, for me, it's, you know, writing a book is a hard thing. I don't, maybe it's easy for some people, but, you know, it's a daunting task. And it involves delving into your past for a memoir like this. So I put it off for a long time, and it sort of kicked around in my head. And I think I realized at some point that, you know, the book that Jeff wanted to make and the book that I wanted to make were kind of different. But he went off and made his own, you know, getting recollections from other people about all of the games that Gottlieb made, which is really fascinating. And, slightly different from what I want. So there's some overlap in his book and my book, but his book really covers Gottlieb and all the games and the people in much more detail, whereas I'm focused pretty much on my own experiences, which not only involve Gottlieb, but then go beyond Gottlieb to other companies. But anyway, there was a point where I felt like I had an outline. I had it sort of organized in my head, just roughly. And then it was a matter of, okay, just you gotta sit down and start writing it. So I don't know. I feel like it was maybe 2017. Maybe I started sitting down and writing it. And, you know, I tried to write a chapter a month, which I was able to do for a few months.
Okay.
But then I wasn't. And then it just kind of dragged on. But it took me a while. And then when I actually had the book, I got feedback. I hired somebody to be an editor for me, who had had some published books, and he was extraordinarily helpful. And, you know, I had people whose opinion I valued read it and give me feedback. And, but then I had to like do all the other stuff because I didn't know the first thing about finding a publisher. So I had and I really didn't try very hard. I think I looked at one or two publishers and then I decided to self-publish. So that meant I had to figure out how to do that. And that was a learning experience.
That's a whole nother layer to add.
And I got some software so I could lay out the book, and then I had to go find images, and I had to go, you know, it was a huge undertaking. I mean, it was crazy. I don't even, you know, I can't believe I did it, to be quite honest. And then I was ready to self-publish, and I actually had the book, found printers, online places where I could list it and sell it online. And 2019, I took it to one show, Free Play Florida, in Orlando, Florida, November of 2019. And I thought, okay, this is cool. It's done. I've got the book. Now all I have to do is go to all these retro gaming shows and share it with people. Well, 2020 came along and boom, no shows. Every appearance I was going to make in 2020 got canceled. And in my boredom, because I really didn't do a lot in 2020, I contacted publishers. I really, in earnest, contacted publishers, and I found one who was interested. And Santa Monica Press, thank you so much. It means a lot to me. We struck a deal. January 1st, I think I signed the contract. Then the bad news was it's going to take like 9 or 10 months to come out with the new version of the book.
Yeah,
because they needed to go through their editing. They needed to do layout. They have, you know, supply chain, blah, blah, blah. And then that got delayed because of COVID. And so it really wasn't until January of this year that the book was finally published. And now it's published. I have it. I can hold it in my hand and sell it to people. Or you could buy it on Amazon. It's available everywhere online. Literally any bookstore you can imagine, you can order it from.
It's kind of serendipitous, though. I mean, it stinks that it took this long because that wasn't your plan. But the fact that it essentially the mass publishing run that you're getting right now is on the 40th anniversary, is in the year that Qubert turns 40. So it's kind of like this, like, worth it. It matches up really well. I know that wasn't the plan. It went through a lot of headaches trying to get to here, but it kind of works out.
Plans don't always work as they, you know, you originally envisioned, but the important thing is that you achieve your goal. So I'm thrilled. I'm absolutely thrilled.
That's great to hear. I was telling you off mic, I have not had a chance to read your book, but I wanted to have.
I'm out of here.
I don't blame you. I wanted to have you on the show so I could A, learn more about your work in the industry, set some facts straight for myself, and also promote it, because I think video game history is, video games mean a lot to me. So when I talk about history, it's because I want to share that love of history, and also get people to learn what it was like to make games back before maybe they were even alive, or before they were cognizant of what gaming was. I always find that stuff interesting.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate you for being interested in that, because, you know, I wouldn't be here talking to you if there weren't people like yourself who are interested in that stuff. The only reason I wrote the book is because there seem to be people interested. Like I said, I don't find my life particularly interesting. You know, it's not, you know, it's just stuff that happened to me, but it's interesting to other people. And because of that, I have learned to respect the fact that it's interesting to other people and try to, you know, get the word out and set the record straight about things. And the biggest compliment people give me, and I've, a number of people have said this to me, is that reading the book does make them feel like they got a sense of what it was like to make a game back in those days. And, you know, I think, as you can probably imagine, the process of making a game bears absolutely no resemblance to the process of playing a game. They're two completely different experiences. So, you know, thank you for your interest in video game history, and you know, you're keeping my story and many other people's stories alive, which is a wonderful thing.
I mean, that's giving me too much credit. I just like talking to people. I like talking to people that I find that I think do interesting things. And that's that's why I have you on. I do something that you do. You do something that I find interesting.
I like talking to people, too. I don't know if you could tell.
I've had other guests on where it's like, and I won't name any names, but it's like trying, and it's not even interviews. It's just other guests where it's like trying to talk to them is like, it's, I have to pull answers out of them. the joke you did before where we were talking about the interaction of theater and the audience, and you're just like, yes, that was 90% of their answers. Like you said that, like that short answer as a joke, but that was like 90% of their answers. And so then I have to stumble and fumble and improvise and try to figure out. Honestly, it's a good learning experience for me. This is my version of an improv class, is podcasting, just fumbling through my words one episode at a time.
You should do an interview where all of your questions have multiple choice answers, and your guest just has to say A, B, C, or D.
I like that. All right. So let's do my two wrap-up questions. I mentioned before Alan Alda and his podcast, Clear and Vivid, and he asked seven questions that invite seven quick answers. We're not, like I said before, I'm not going to ask you all seven questions. I'm just going to pick one of them. One that I was curious about for you, that I'm going to just pick one of them, is what book changed your life?
Wow. That's a tough one. I've read a lot of books in my time.
It can be something that just whatever pops your mind. You don't even have to elaborate if you don't want to. You can just blurt it out.
I mean, honestly, the book that changed my life probably more than anything else, it's called A Course in Miracles. Have you ever heard of it?
I have not. What is it? What's it about?
It is a cross between, you know, I don't know how much detail I can get into it. It's actually divided into three sections. The first section is almost like a Bible. It's a text with somewhat religious overtones. That didn't speak to me so much. But there is a second section, which is daily lessons, 365 daily lessons. And then there's a third section called A Manual for Teachers, I believe is what it's called. And I just found that somewhat life-changing. It just changes your perspective on life, or at least changed mine. Spoke to me in ways that had a really wonderful, positive effect on my life.
That's really interesting. I looked it up real quick, and it says, according to Google, so once again, take it for what it's worth. Maybe the facts are wrong. There is no author attributed to this. It was scribed by Helen Schuman or Schuchman. I can't pronounce her last name. That's interesting. All right. So there we go. A book that changed your life. I will have to. I don't read as often as I should, but maybe I'll check this out then.
Well, I think a book that will change your life is called Creating Qbert.
Yes, listeners.
Classic Video Games by Warra Davis.
I would agree.
Santa Monica Press.
I will include a link to where listeners can buy your book in the show notes as well. So that way they can just click right on it. They don't have to go very far. My last question, what I wrap up all my interviews with, is questions from Courtney. I don't have a theme song for this yet, so just da-da-da-da-da, questions for Courtney. My wife famously knows nothing about the video game, or not, I shouldn't say knows nothing, knows very little about gaming and geek culture and all that good stuff. So she asks you today, knowing nothing about what you do or what you have done, if you could bring one mythical creature to life, what would it be?
Wow. One mythical creature. Can I get a multiple choice on this?
All right. Centaur. The Loch Ness Monster. What's other mythical creatures? The Cyclops. Let's go more Greek. I already said centaur. What's the bull with the half bull, half human? Centaur's half horse. What's the bull?
Oh, I'm not sure. But I have to say, I might go with a griffin. And the only reason is because my son's name is Griffin. So I would like my son. I want to be with my son.
Imagine giving Griffin a griffin.
Exactly.
I like it.
By the way, the Loch Ness Monster is not a mythical creature. It's real.
Wasn't there just like some study recently, right? I actually read somewhere recently where some scientific study was done where it was like, oh, it's possible it actually exists in there.
Well, yeah. I mean, why wouldn't it be possible? Everything is possible. I mean, you can't prove that something doesn't exist, right? It's like you can't prove a negative scientifically. You cannot prove a negative because it may not just not have been found yet, right?
That's true. That's so a griffin. That's a good answer. I don't know what mine would be.
I wish I was more well versed on mythical creatures. To be quite honest, I really don't know that many off the top of my head.
Neither do I. I literally, Minotaur, that's the half bull, half
human
thing. I could not think, it just came to me now. I go with Centaur. I'm just because it's the first thing. Actually, good reason why I'd go with Centaur. Every year, my friends and I, we have an ugly Christmas sweater party, and I have an ugly Christmas sweater that has Santa as a centaur. It's Santar, if you will.
Oh,
he's ripped with like an 8-pack, and he's half horse, and it's one of the goofiest things I've ever seen. But it's my ugly Christmas sweater for the ugly Christmas sweater party.
Is there a mythical creature that's half dog and half cat? I would like to see that come to life.
There's a Nickelodeon cartoon from the late 90s called Cat Dog, if that counts.
Can I tell you a crazy story?
Yes,
I auditioned to be the voice of Cat Dog.
What? Really?
Yes. I didn't get it, obviously. But I did audition to be the voice of Cat Dog.
That's true. That is wild. Have you done any voices for animated features or like games at all? I didn't look too far into your IMDb credits, so I wasn't sure if there was any on there.
When I worked at Williams, I was the voice of the character Wet Willie in the pinball machine Whitewater.
Okay, there we go.
There was also a Shuffle Alley. You know what Shuffle Alleys are, right? They're like, you know, coin-op bowling machines with a hockey puck instead of a ball. And I did the voice in at least one of those. I have done some voice work, but not, I don't think I've ever done animation voice work. Yeah.
I've always wanted to like try it myself, but I'm not. Acting is the first component of doing voice acting, and I am not an actor, like I said before. But all right. That should do it for this episode of the Still Loading Podcast. Warren, thank you so much for joining me. Where can the good people find you online? Where can they find you online? And is there any, besides the book, is there anything else you'd like to promote?
Okay, well, they can find me on Twitter, at WarrenDavis29. Also, my public Facebook page is also facebook.com/ Warren Davis 29. A lot of people try to friend me on my personal Facebook page, but I will not accept
I don't blame
friend
you.
Requests from people I don't
I
know.
I don't blame you.
Or you know, sometimes there are people I met at a show or something, but I reserve my personal page for my friends and family. But a great way to keep in touch is my public page. And then I have a website where I can sell my book autographed. And that is Warren Davis Shop, all one word, .square.site, S-I-T-E. And the only thing to promote, I'm really spending a lot of time going to retro gaming shows this year to promote the book. So I've already been this year to something like eight or nine different cities. Wow. This weekend, I'm going to be in Phoenix at the Game On Expo. That might be over by the time people hear this.
Yes. So this episode, just to give you a frame of reference, will be out August 21st.
August 21st. Well, then I will be on my way the following weekend to South Bend, Indiana, for the Power Up South Bend Retro Gaming Con. I'll be in Cleveland in September. A whole slew of places in October, but this year, yeah, it's a really heavy schedule for me, and I'm loving it. I'm loving going around and meeting people and sharing my book. So come and see me if I am heading to a city near you.
All right. And as usual, for me, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillOwningPod on all of them. If you want to email me, you can email me StillOwningContact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, you can do that in a number of ways. You can give it a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use, because that helps more people find the show and it makes me feel warm and fuzzy. And I like feeling warm and fuzzy. You can also support the show monetarily by going to Patreon.com/StillOwningPod. For just $1 a month, you'll get each episode a couple days early and at a higher bit rate, as well as access to a patron exclusive Discord. If you want to support the show at the $5 level, you will get all of that, as well as 2 bonus episodes a month, which usually consists of me rambling about some video game topic, ranting against NFTs, talking about retro magazines and old video game magazines and all that good stuff. So Patreon.com/StillOwningPod. But the most important shout out is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to support them, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. And that will do it for this episode of Still Loading. Warren, thank you so much for setting aside some time tonight. Thank you for being patient with me with some of this information and helping not only clear stuff up for me, but for my listeners. I had a really good time speaking with you.
Well, thank you, Josh. I did as well, and I appreciate all of your efforts on behalf of video game history. So thanks, and keep it up. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And that will do it, everyone. Thank you all for listening. I will see you all next time. ¶¶